The Harlot in Revelation 17 and 19 by B. Holweda. Translator's Preface. This is a translation of the Dutch publication De Hoer in Openbaring 17 and 19, written by Professor B. Holweda in the early 1950s. As the introduction will inform the reader, it was written in defense of Professor Holweda's exegesis of Revelation 17 through 19, with regards to the harlot. This exegesis was originally put forth in 1949 in two speeches at a youth rally. Together they are available in English as translated by Dr. P. Y. de Jong under the title The Church in the Last Judgment. They also should be available soon from Inheritance Publications in combination with the present defense in one booklet as Bride or Harlot. Wherever possible, a literal translation has been employed to maintain Professor Holweda's true intended meaning. It is the hope of those involved in the translation that this publication will assist in the edification of the Church of Christ, and thereby promote his honor and glory through studying the recurring themes in the history of salvation. Mrs. R. Hoeksma and other ladies. Introduction. This publication is more or less a continuation of and an addition to the first one which I wrote for this series, entitled The Church in the Last Judgment. However, this one is somewhat different in format. One who is familiar with the first one will understand why this is so, for the first one consisted of two speeches which I gave at a youth rally in 1949 in Wassenaar. Naturally, because of this, it was theatrical in character. The second publication, however, came to be mostly due to the criticisms the first one received. Since I am of the opinion that this criticism is to be rejected and deserves a refutation, I was compelled to write this one in a polemical format. However, this does not mean that in the pages which follow I will answer all the criticism which drew my attention. For instance, I refuse to carry on the controversy regarding criticism from synodical quarters. Footnote: by synodical, the author means the people who followed the Synod of the Reformed Churches in the Netherlands in 1944. Professor Dr. Herman Ridderbos wrote an article in Gereformeerd Weekblad under the heading Liberation and Apocalyptics, in which he, in a very authoritative tone, asserted a great deal without proving anything. The harlot of Revelation 17 is not the church, but the world, according to Ridderbos. And what is more, he would not be able to name a reputable exegete today which would support such an interpretation, or even take the possibility into consideration. Of course, this does not mean that these exegetes do not exist, but only that Ridderbos does not know of them. Apparently, he does not even seem to know that his own father-in-law, Mr. J. H. Cock, published, in 1926, for the third time even, a book about Revelation with the beautiful title The Hemel Geopend, The Heavens Revealed. It was a new publication of a national edition. The writer of the book was Dr. J. C. de Moor, who acquired his degree at the same university as Ridderbos. De Moor knows a thing or two about exegesis, whose outstanding services in our churches is most certainly well known. De Moor also recognized the harlot of Revelation 17 as the false church, and, as had been stated previously, Mr. Cock has brought this exegesis to the attention of the people, three times over. More serious than this lack of information is the fact that Professor Ridderbos does not come up with any essential argumentation against my lectured exegesis. His whole article is nothing more than a fierce and bitter outburst in which he does not even attempt to be polite. In this situation, a discussion with people such as Ridderbos has no merit. Also, from some of our own brothers, I received opposition regarding this matter. And by one of them, Reverend Ploy, I was openly attacked and challenged. I promised several of them, long before the article by Professor Ridderbos was published, that I would return to this exegetical problem as soon as time permitted. To answer questions from brothers is always possible, is it not? And it is also right to reply to criticisms of brothers, even more so since Reverend Ploy tried to deliver an essential refutation. All questions which were put to me will gradually be dealt with in my answer to Reverend Ploy. It is impossible for me to repeat all of his articles here, but I believe that the readers will receive sufficient orientation and that I will do justice to Reverend Ploy by giving the following summary which he himself gave when he concluded his series of articles. We now have to come to the conclusion of our criticism of Professor Holweda's exegesis of Revelation 17, at the same time answering our own questions which came up in these articles. We have found that Professor Holweda's argument is based on three pillars. A. The astonishment of the Apostle John regarding the harlot, whom he recognizes as the woman of Revelation 12, the Church. B. His understanding of Babylon the Great in a spiritual sense as being Jerusalem. And C. His reference to Ezekiel 16 and 23, where the harlot is named Jerusalem. After investigating these three pillars, our conclusion must be A. That Professor Holweda's explanation of John's astonishment has the context in which the text was written against him. B. That Professor Holweda's explanation of Babylon the Great as being Jerusalem is not based on solid exegetical grounds, and that wherever mention is made in the last book of the Bible of the great city, it refers to the city of Rome in those days, exemplifying the big secular city of the end of time. And C. That Professor Holweda, by his reference to Ezekiel 16 and 23, does no justice to the striking and multiple quotations in Revelation 18, taken from Isaiah 13, 21, 23, 47, and 48, Jeremiah 50 and 51, and Ezekiel 26 and 27, in which chapters no mention is made of a church city, Jerusalem, but rather a secular city, Babel, Tyre, or Nineveh, as in Nahum 3. With this, we believe that we have attacked the issue in an essential manner with good argumentation against an exegesis which has become quite popular among us today, an exegesis which is propagated in all possible forms, yes, which is poured out upon our youth especially. However, proper argumentation is given nowhere. Section 2. The Authority of Common Opinions. Permit me to begin with Reverend Ploy's complaint, namely that I have not given reasonable argumentation for my exegesis. According to Reverend Ploy, this is in agreement with the manner in which this exegesis was forced down the throats of our youth. This is regrettable. He continues to say that he hopes his criticism may contribute to break the spell of Professor Holweda's exegesis, bring further reflection upon the matter, that thereby public account may be rendered. I presume that I must understand it in this way. According to Reverend Ploy, I committed a resentful rashness against our youth by pouring a new exegesis into them and leaving the one of Professor Gridanus, the common one. I then had to first give public account of the grounds on which I had left the exegesis of Professor Gridanus, before I had the moral right to speak to the youth in such a popular fashion. To come straight to the point, I do not believe a word of this. Anyone who speaks to the congregation from the pulpit or to the youth from a different platform must know what he is discussing and should have truly examined the issue. Permit me to say, for example, in the course of his study, a person comes upon a text with three or more different explanations, and he himself has to weigh the arguments over against one another, coming to a well-considered choice of his own. But he does not have the moral obligation to first publicly justify his not-so-popular choice of exegesis before he is allowed to present it. Otherwise, no minister would be allowed on the pulpit anymore. For after all, there are very few texts in which differences in exegetical opinions do not exist. If a minister, before he would be allowed to preach, first had to defend his explanation in a more or less knowledgeable way, then we might as well all pack up and leave. It would boil down to this. We would have censorship on exegesis. In this manner, only one particular explanation would be proclaimed as the common one, to which everyone would be bound, while someone who had a different understanding would first have to give account for his scholarly argumentation before he would be allowed to speak to the congregation or its youth. Fortunately, we do not have this situation yet. I believe that the binding of Scripture and confession is sufficient, and everyone who in his preaching and oration adheres to these has the right to present his explanation, which he, on a solid basis, contends to be the correct interpretation. Just like myself, Reverend Ploy must have heard or read sermons in which he came to the conclusion, the preacher followed the exegesis of A, but I feel more for the opinion of B. Do we then have to express our sadness because the minister left the exegesis of B? I think not. Moreover, how often does Reverend Ploy want to put this public accountability into practice? I mean, who has to form this committee to judge? Of course, not the congregation. They receive the popular education. Obviously, these have to be a number of people who are capable to analyze the not-so-popular. A number of theologians, perhaps? After all, it is a matter of spiritual exegesis. Who has to appoint these? And how will they be able to agree among themselves? Do they have the infallible exegesis? If such a committee came into existence, is Reverend Ploy himself prepared to request preaching consent if he is holding an exegesis which deviates from the norm? Reverend Ploy is using the easy term common exegesis. I had my fill of this term when ecclesiastical assemblies were commissioned against people who in preaching and writing did not agree with opinions which were announced as being common. I believe that the pitiful fencing of the term common was demonstrated clearly in those days. At what time must or may we call an opinion common? Already at first glance, pro and con opinions become readily evident, even when dealing with one point. Who is then to decide which is the common view? Can anyone, no matter who, even trace how many supporters an opinion has? Does one have the necessary data at his disposal? And suppose that he was actually able to decide opinion A was shared by 10, B by 8, C by 11, and D by 3. Which interpretation is to be dubbed common? Is then the decision in the masses? Does it then become a matter of relative or absolute majority? Remaining within the confines of Revelation 17, Reverend Ploy must himself immediately agree that there are, at minimum, three different exegeses, each with numerous variations. I have read extensively about this chapter, and I doubt if there are even two persons who think the same. For instance, there is the opinion of the commentators who wrote the annotations to the Dordt Study Bible, mostly followed by the Moore. Then there is the different explanation of Professor Greidanus, and Rignalda's is different also. With these examples, I remain within the Reformed community of the Netherlands. If we go outside of this circle and read the explanations of Sclater, Sahn, Charles, Bousset, Kiddel, and others, who then is yet to say whose is the popular opinion? Reverend Ploy is quite intelligent if he, regarding Revelation 17, can trace how many adhere to the annotations of the Dordt Study Bible, how many were influenced by the commentaries of Professor Greidanus or by the book by Reverend Rignalda. Common opinions are fictitious. Section 3. The Great Difficulty of the Common Explanation. Reverend Ploy complains that I fail to give reasonable argumentation for my thesis. This complaint astonished me, regardless of what I wrote before. I in no wise expected such a remark, especially after a Reverend Ploy's own articles. His criticism was aimed at three pillars, on which my opinion seemed to be resting. Regarding pillars, I certainly must be allowed to assume he meant the points of complete support on which my whole argument was resting, the fundamental ideas which uphold everything, just as pillars under a bridge. When, in this context, Reverend Ploy employs the verb seem, then I may take it for granted that he discovered, according to his own conviction, these three points of support on which the whole case is resting. This is why I do not understand his complaint regarding the lack of argumentation, nor his request for public account. For an argument is, after all, proof of a thesis. As a matter of fact, the same thing as a pillar of a thesis. In what way can Reverend Ploy, on the one hand, point to the pillars and, on the other hand, say that these are not there? This is unfortunate for Reverend Ploy, for he could have saved himself the trouble. He fought against pillars, but they were no pillars at all. What he refers to under A, B, and C are sections of my speech which are not arguments of support. These three points belong to the superstructure, not to the foundation under it, which, at times, can be referred to as pillars. Reverend Ploy should not take offense, but I have the impression that he was somewhat hasty in the writing of his articles. What I mean to say is, he did not pay enough attention to the great deal of points which are at stake here. He also does not seem aware of the questionability of the exegesis he is advocating. Perhaps he will reply, "This remark applies to Gridanus also," but only partly so, I believe. Anyone who has studied the Book of Revelation knows of the many problems this book puts before the reader, especially in terms of exegesis. Professor Gridanus amended several points of his argument in the course of the years. A simple comparison between his first and last study of Revelation will make this evident. Gridanus did not totally comprehend this book, but this is nothing to be ashamed of, for no one will ever be finished with it. At least Gridanus brought us a great deal closer. Although I could not accept his solution, Gridanus still shows that he at least clearly recognized the problems. I believe that Reverend Ploy reads and follows Gridanus, but he does not consider the problems sufficiently. One point in particular struck me. Reverend Ploy says in one of his articles, "The explanation of Gridanus, at first reading, gives the impression of contemplating two ideas. For example, Rome as willpower and Rome as papal power. On closer examination, this impression is replaced by another, namely that, also when Gridanus speaks of papal power, he puts the emphasis more on the thought of power than on the idea of false church." Reverend Ploy is of the opinion that a certain contradiction in the exegesis of Gridanus is only a deception, and that he in fact sees the harlot and the beast everywhere as being identical. I cannot agree with this, for Gridanus wrote in connection with this woman, "She is sitting on the beast, and, nevertheless, is distinguished from its heads, the papal power and the Roman church. No more than this beast does this woman represent more than one power at a time. This beast is sometimes the entire world power, then again certain embodiments of it, then anti-Christian, then the Roman world dictatorship in her various forms of existence, for example, imperial, papal, or anti-Christian." Korte Verklaring, page 252. It is plain to see Gridanus considered harlot and beast as being identical. However, not completely. He also continued to realize that he had to distinguish them, and because of this, he ran into difficulties. for what is nearly identical is difficult to distinguish. Gridanus found the solution in this, that both beast and harlot, at different points in time, manifest themselves. For instance, in verse 16 and further, the Antichrist and his assistants are, in the opinion of Gridanus, a particular manifestation of the world power, and the harlot an other concrete form of this, the papal church. I am not satisfied with this solution, and I will come back to this later on. There is in the exegesis of Gridanus an unresolved tension between the identification and distinction of harlot and beast. He rightly perceived that one faces a dilemma with this exegesis of Revelation 17, if one does not persist in distinguishing these two. I believe that Reverend Ploy entangles himself in hopeless difficulties if he rigidly holds on to the identical quality of these. Difficulties which, in my opinion, cannot be resolved. If one should say, the harlot is the world, or the world power, and the beast as well, then he finds himself immediately entangled into mysteries. A. The harlot sits on the beast. Verse 3. Explanation. The world power sits on the world power. But my question is, what does that mean, sitting on? How is it possible for one to sit on himself? B. The harlot is completely undressed, eaten, and burnt by the 10 horns of the beast. Verse 16. Explanation. The world power of the last hour is being destroyed by the anti-Christian world power. If the harlot is not the false church, but the world power, as Reverend Ploy argues, then she is at the moment of verse 16 herself the anti-Christian world power, and practically identical with the 10 horns, which are busy making her desolate and are burning her. In other words, the world power is devouring itself, or the Antichrist eats itself and destroys its own kingdom? I am asking this because I am totally unable to understand this explanation. Gridanus at least says that in verse 16 we must think of the false church, the papal one. C. This harlot commits adultery with the kings of the earth, 18 verse 9. In other words, with the rulers of this world power. But if the harlot also represents the world power, then it would mean that she commits adultery with herself. What does this mean? Reverend Ploy thinks that he can get out of this dilemma by simply referring to several texts from the Old Testament where adultery is used when pointing to idolatry. In this case, we would get, the world power is committing idolatry with itself. I did not accurately examine all the texts which Reverend Ploy refers to. I am not convinced that these indicated passages are speaking of idolatry. Let us leave this aside for the time being. In all cases, it is clear that one city committed adultery with another city. Nowhere does it say that Tyre, Nineveh, etc. are committing adultery with themselves, but they did so with other powers. Adultery is committed by two distinct powers. That is why I also do not understand the references to these texts in the explanation of Revelation 17, in order to defend his opinion on the identification of the harlot and the beast. We can only speak of adultery, providing that we speak of two parties. But two parties do not exist when we make them identical. Do not misunderstand me. I readily admit that idolatry is often qualified as adultery. This is possible because there is first a covenant between two parties, namely God and his people. The second party became unfaithful to her husband by involving herself with a third party. So, two distinguishable parties always do exist. As far as I am aware, the Bible speaks of people who commit adultery with idols, but not of the world committing adultery with itself. These dilemmas aroused my doubts regarding the identification theory. If harlot and beast are actually the same power, then the world sits on herself, and I fail to understand what this is supposed to mean. Then she kills and eats herself, but this is in contradiction with the context. Then she commits adultery with herself. But as far as I know, that is not what the Bible is calling idolatry. Nothing positive has yet been said of my exegesis, the harlot is the false church. At this time, I was only concerned to make it clear why I started to doubt what Reverend Ploy calls the popular opinion. For the moment, I will not go any further than the thesis, harlot and beast are distinguishable. They are two diverse concrete bodies. Section 4. Which data must be taken into consideration? It is not necessary to dwell on the question of what should be understood regarding the beast. I think that Reverend Ploy agrees with me that the beast is the description of the world empire, or for that matter, the world state, which manifests itself in different forms and rears its various heads in the course of history. But the unanimity is lost as soon as the question is asked, which solid power does the harlot symbolize? It is superfluous, in my opinion, to go into the ideas of all sorts of commentators who are critical of Holy Scripture. There are several theories which call attention to the whole exegesis of Revelation and as such also touch chapter 17. I am thinking of the traditional historical, time historical, end historical, and the general historical conceptions. The explanation of the starting point and method of each of these theories would lead me too far off topic. Moreover, too much scientific nonsense would enter into the picture. I hold fast to my conviction that all readers, if they are able to judge this, will agree with me that these opinions do not do justice to Scripture and ought to be rejected by believers in Holy Scripture. In this, Reverend Ploy also kept himself to the explanations which were given within Reformed circles, and I reserve the right to keep my answer within the bounds of his intention. I am of the opinion that in our circles we can reduce the meaning of the harlot to three. A. The harlot is the world power, and therefore practically identical to the beast. B. The harlot is an indication of the world, but then especially from the aspect of culture and wealth. In other words, the harlot is culture. C. The harlot is the false church. I admit this diagram is more or less simplistic, for there are many variations, modifications and combinations. With Professor Gradanus, for instance, we already see more or less a combination of A and C. Naturally, the possibility exists for several other combinations and modifications. I believe there is no point in going into this. In short, permit me to indicate three views: the political, A, the cultural, B, and the ecclesiastical, C. In order to find an answer, we must first carefully gather the data which Scripture offers us. And it would be wise to immediately classify this data. For we find one piece of data in the description of John's vision, and another in the explanation which the angel gives him. I classify then 1. Data in the description of John's vision. A. She is portrayed as a woman. B. Further on as a woman called the great harlot because of her evil practices. For that matter, a woman who is thus stipulated over against the point of marital fidelity, verse 1 and 2, compare 4b and 5b. C. She is introduced as sitting on the scarlet beast, which has 7 heads and 10 horns, verse 3. D. She is also said to be sitting on many waters, verse 1. E. She commits her adultery with the kings as well as with all inhabitants of the earth. Verse 2. F. Her garment is characterized as manufactured of purple and scarlet. Her ornaments consist of gold, jewels, and pearls, and she has a golden cup in her hand. Verse 4. G. John sees the name written on her forehead, Mystery, Babylon the Great, Mother of Harlots and Abominations of the Earth. Verse 5. 8. She is drunk with the blood of the saints and the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. Verse 6. 2. Data and the explanation which the angel gives of this vision, inclusive of the sections in chapters 18 and 19. A. Her sitting on the scarlet beast with seven heads is explained as sitting on seven mountains and at the same time sitting on seven kings. Verse 9 and 10. This corresponds with 1c. B. Her sitting on many waters is explained as her position in the midst of peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues. Verse 15. C. 1d. C. Her destruction comes when the ten horns of the beast begin to hate, destroy, undress, eat, and burden her. Verse 16. D. She is the great city, Greek Polis. Verse 18a. E. As such, she reigns over the kings of the earth. Verse 18b. F. The people of the Lord are summoned to come out of her, lest they take part in her sins and share in her judgments. 18 verse 4 and further. G. The wealth of her garment is illustrated in 18 verse 7, 11 and further. Compare 1f. H. The matter of her drunkenness with the blood of the saints is raised again in 18 verse 20, 24, 19 verse 2, compared 1:8. I. Those who committed adultery with her are appalled when her judgment comes upon her, 18 verse 9 and further. K. On the other hand, there is rejoicing in heaven, for now the marriage of the Lamb has come. 19 verse 7 and further. As far as I know, I combined all the elements which we have to bring into consideration for the explanation. Offhand, we can see right away that the angel does not go into all the sections of the vision, and at the same time other elements are mentioned in the explanation which John did not bring into account. Methodically, it seems correct to start with the data of group 2. The vision is obscure in many respects itself, is it not? This is the reason why the angel gives John further information. If we want to approach the vision, then we have to start our examination by what the angel himself says pertaining to the explanation. According to me, we have to attempt to give a suitable account from the data classified under group 2 to the elements arranged under group 1. Section 5. Rejection of the cultural opinion. As far as I am concerned, one of the aforementioned opinions must be eliminated immediately, in particular, the cultural conception. The world as cultural power is not the denotation of the term harlot. 1. Although no one will deny, especially with respect to chapter 18, that there is a close connection between the harlot and culture, it cannot be said that John teaches the destruction of the world with her culture in the days of the eighth king here. We saw, did we not, comparing the data mentioned under 2G, that a world still exists after the harlot and her wealth have perished. Also the world powers, the political mighty ones, yet exists, 18 verse 9. As well as the people who took charge of the manufacturing, transporting, and selling of this wealth. Therefore, it is incorrect to say that culture is ruined at this very moment, not even if they add to this the limitation that the apostate culture is meant here. The merchants, etc., cannot see a consumer's market anymore for their luxury articles, which they formerly supplied to the harlot. Verse 11. Yet there is no indication at all that the apostate culture as such has disappeared, or that the world as cultural power has ceased to exist. 2. To this we add 1f. It is certainly significant that the vision is making a distinction between the harlot herself on the one hand and the garment, as well as her adornments, on the other. 3. If we come to the understanding that the harlot is the world as cultural power, then what it says in 19 verse 3 has to be taken seriously. Her smoke goes up forever and ever. This positively signifies that the destruction is without remainder and definite. Therefore, this blaze is never extinguished. Then, from this point of reference, we have to accept the fact that the world power, with her apostate culture, is ruined forever. Yet, this does not coincide with the suggestion of chapter 18, on which we touched under group 1. 4. Even more important, at a time the harlot with her display goes up in flames, the eighth king, the Antichrist, is ruling with his henchmen. The world power has not disappeared absolutely yet. Are they of the opinion that this eighth anti-Christian power will be without culture? I believe that scripture teaches us that especially in those days the apostate culture will reach its highest point. They will still send each other presents, 11 verse 10, and rejoice. Cultural means and possibilities are abundant. Paul, for that matter, speaks in the same manner in 2 Thessalonians 2. The Antichrist will come with all power, signs, and lying wonders, with all unrighteous deception, verse 9 and 10. This surely means that the world, as cultural power, reaches the most extreme development, to a culture of hellish refinement. The Antichrist only finishes off the existence of the harlot and the monuments of the culture which she built, but not the world power or the world empire, not even if we take it only from the cultural perspective. I should say a few more things about this, for there are authors who, when discussing the harlot, think only of one specific historical greatness of the world empire, which is the Roman Empire. For example, Professor Schilder in Christus and Kultur, Christ and Culture, page 71, compare his book on the Revelation of John, is still virtually in agreement with Gredanus. This way we are ending up with, the Antichrist does not make an end of the world and its culture, but of one specific empire and the typical culture of its realm. Yet, I think that the text itself contradicts the identification the harlot is the Roman Empire with its cultural wealth. I cannot go into this in detail. I have to refer to my first brochure, especially to those sections in which I give an exegesis of the beast with its seven heads. I allow myself to add one comment yet. If the harlot is the identification of the Roman Empire, then she is identical with the sixth head, for I do not believe that anyone will contradict by saying the sixth head refers to the Roman Empire. But exactly in this head, the beast receives a deadly wound. The beast itself rears up again after a while, but this does not mean that the sixth head appears for a second time, but the beast lifts up its seventh head. In other words, the world empire, as portrayed by the Roman Empire, is smitten. If we identify the harlot with this empire, it follows that the harlot, at this time, receives the death blow. But this contradicts with the rest of the chapter. At the moment when the beast lays at death's door, the woman is in her prime. She deceives the thousands and she exhibits all her glory. Furthermore, she does not receive her finishing blow until the days of the eighth king, the Antichrist. She is not ruined with the sixth king, and for this reason cannot be identical to the Roman Empire. I link to this a few comments I made under 2D. This harlot is mentioned in verse 18 as the great city, Greek polis. I maintain that this pleads against the cultural opinion, and advance has great meaning for that which is discussed later. I cannot give an elaborate discussion here on the meaning of the word palace, but I vividly remember that I, in one of the first winters during the war, was engaged for some time in a treatise on this subject, which fascinated me tremendously. I have in mind the book by Carl Ludwig Schmidt, Die Palais in Kirche und Welt. The Palais in Church and Welt, Zurich, 1940. Schmidt first gives, as is typical of him, a great deal of linguistic material. According to Schmidt, palace first means city, but it also means the association of citizens, the city municipality, the city state, and the state. I hope the reader is able to understand this citation. Consequently, this is a term which indicates the association of people with citizen rights and obligations between government and subjects, between laws and officers. It should be noted, however, that Schmidt does understand the harlot to be Rome, verse 13, and, as such, anything but support for the exegesis I defend, although all of this is very important. In any case, with polis is meant a specific community, an organized relevant society. Therefore, it seems impossible for me to understand world as a cultural power when we speak of the harlot. The world in the sense of the world power can indeed be called polis, but the world from a specific aspect, the world as cultural power, can never be named polis. Aspects must remain abstract in nature, but not concrete communities. As far as I am concerned, the use of the term polis pleads very strongly against the cultural exegesis. If this is true, and I truly believe that it is, then there are only two possibilities left. The political, which sees the harlot as a world power in all her existence, or one certain embodiment of it, Rome, and the ecclesiastical, which understands this to be the false church. Because of what I have previously demonstrated, we have to distinguish between the harlot and the beast and see them as being separate entities. My conception of what is meant remains uncertain as long as there are several possibilities. The picture becomes clear when the possibilities are reduced to the dilemma either world empire or false church. The beast is the world empire, is it not? And is distinct from the harlot. Consequently, there remains no other possibility than the ecclesiastical. Section 6. Further considerations of scripture references. Naturally, it must yet be determined if the conclusion we first arrived at is supported or refuted by the above-mentioned classified data. First, we will pursue the ones I arranged under 2. A. The woman sitting on the beast with 7 heads is explained as sitting on 7 mountains. Previously, I pointed out that whoever identifies harlot with the beast actually makes the world power sit on itself. With this, the representation becomes obscure and it becomes difficult to give a reasonable explanation. Yet, the angel gives an explanation. The 7 heads, first and foremost, portray 7 mountains. Hereby is the geographical position of the harlot indicated. As far as I can ascertain, it is nowhere imputed, also not by myself, that these 7 mountains point toward Rome, the city on 7 hills. A little further on, 2b, it is stated, however, that the sitting of the woman between waters indicates her position between peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues. Hereby it is not denied that this harlot resides in Rome, but definitely that she does not abide there only, for she has a place in the midst of all peoples, international, does she not? In other words, the harlot has her place in the world center of this time, yet she also has expanded internationally. Do we now ask the question, is there anything decided insofar as the choice between ecclesiastical and political opinions are concerned? I believe the answer must be negative. For when we interpret harlot here as an indication of the world power, then we will come to a reasonable conclusion. This world power is established in Rome as center, and it has its suits internationally. Yet we see no reason either why this would contradict the ecclesiastical opinion. The church has already expanded internationally and has obtained a place in Rome as well. The false church? Indeed, for the Jews resided in Rome and were scattered among all peoples at the time when John wrote Revelation. I do not believe that what we understand in the Belgic Confession, both pertinently and terminologically, as false church, was unknown to John. I think here of 2 verse 9, where he writes of those who say they are Jews but are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. John is familiar with a society who claims to be the congregation of the living God, but in reality is a synagogue of Satan. Anyone who understands that a synagogue is one of the terms which indicates an ecclesiastical gathering can also comprehend that John knows of those congregations which bear this name illegitimately. Compare this with the beginning of Article 29 of the Belgic Confession. In other words, what was mentioned under A neither proves nor disproves anything of the ecclesiastical view. B. The sitting on the seven heads is at the same time explained as sitting on seven kings, of which five have already fallen. The sixth is present at the time, while the seventh does not appear until later. The historical place of the harlot is indicated by this. She is said to be sitting on the beast with seven heads. This is, according to the explanation, she is sitting on the world empire, which in the past already showed five forms of existence, and at this time exhibits the sixth form, and will evolve further in the future. We shall determine if this is of future benefit for us. The sixth head is the Roman Empire. According to some, the harlot is the world power also. But what does the sitting on then mean? The world power would then be sitting on itself. This is meaningless. Perhaps we could yet consider if this might be a feature of the vision which could be ignored. But this is at odds with the explanation of the angel, as he brings this section into account. He indicates this sitting on to be geographical as well as a historical position. If we now understand the harlot as the empire, then the whole indication of the historical position is thereby nullified. If we nevertheless think of the false church, then the meaning is preserved. The sitting on then means that this false church leans on the world power and is sustained by it. She relies on the empire as it, in the course of the ages, has received its center in Rome and from there puts her iron hand on all peoples of the then known earth. Compare Gridanus, Korte Verklaring, page 252. Korte Verklaring means short commentary. Gridanus wrote the volume on the Revelation to John. This section pleads in favor of the ecclesiastical opinion and against the political. C. It says in verse 16 that the ten horns torture the harlot in a horrible manner. I pointed out earlier that also Gridanus, although he forcefully persists in the correlation between the harlot and the beast, could not find his direction clearly in this verse, and thus speaks of this verse as pointing to the papal church. I also stated that I completely agree with Gridanus. Here we must think of two distinct entities when dealing with harlot and beast. I do not want to limit this to the papal church, but I also understand this to be the false church in various forms, as does the Belgic Confession. In accordance with this, I refer to Ezekiel 16 and 23. This parallel has been seen by many, and is very remarkable. Reverend Ploy does not deny this either, although he tries to make the appeal to Ezekiel ineffective by asking some questions which he would rather not express. For didn't he write, "Now we will not ask if the Jerusalem of Ezekiel 16 and 23 already was false church, and neither will we ask if the false church could still expect prophecy of salvation, like the Jerusalem of Ezekiel 16, although these questions are of importance." I would like to go into these questions on account of their importance. Was Jerusalem then already false church? Yes, and why would she not be considered such? I do not wish to answer this question in a negative manner. My reasons are as follows. In the first place, what does the confession understand by false church? Our confession, according to the texts under Article 29, French edition 1619, see Backhuizen van der Brink, page 188, thinks of the church which commits adultery by breaking the covenant. We should also compare the various editions which Backhuizen van der Brink compares with each other. It is remarkable that Revelation 2 verse 9 and 17 verse 3 are considered as connected here. I have already commented on the first text. In other words, our confession speaks here also of the adulterous church when it speaks of the false church. Compare textual references. Exactly the same case as in Ezekiel 16. If Reverend Ploy asks, could Jerusalem then be called a false church? Then I answer, what does our confession mean with this term other than the sin of Ezekiel 16? In the second place, Reverend Ploy should also know that in the Reformed symbolism of the time, false and adulterous are interchangeable comprehensions, and that harlot, meretrix, occurs as synonym of false church, ecclesia falsa. The Scottish Confession, 1560, discusses the marks by which the true church is distinguished from the false church, Article 18, and says in the context, the characteristics and marks by which the pure bride of Christ can be distinguished from the unclean and abominable harlot, namely the church or assembly of the ungodly. Also the Hungarian Confession, 1562, has a superscription on Chapter 5, Article 7, of the marks by which the true church is distinguished from the adulterous one. Compare Muller's edition on pages 257 and 428. The term false church is not understood if we do not see adulterous church and harlot as synonymous during this time period. Why can Jerusalem, which was punished in Ezekiel 16 for its adultery, then not be called false church in light of Calvinistic confessions? Furthermore, did Israel not destroy itself with the services of the high places? And was not the adultery, the unfaithfulness to the Lord, the part which was false in this church assembly? And does it not get this far eventually, so that on account of these sins someone like Hosea had to say to the people, "You are not my people"? Do the prophets not speak of a bill of divorce? Just because Ezekiel, in his judgment on the adultery of Jerusalem, ends with the promise of salvation, Reverend Ploy wants to conclude that John, in chapter 17 verse 16, did not have his eye on Ezekiel, because John does not know any more of mercy for the harlot. I am unable to understand this. If the Lord, during an earlier period of apostasy within his church, was inclined to grant grace to his church again, does this mean that he will also be merciful to it in the final phase of its history? Revelation 17 does deal with the end of the ages. The exile was the beginning and shadow of the definite downfall of the apostate church, but not yet as beginning and shadow of the end itself. A parallel could be drawn here with sin. Christ says that only the sin against the Holy Spirit is unpardonable. This sin was not yet known in the Old Testament because the Spirit was not yet in his full essence, as Jesus Christ had not yet been glorified. Yet the Old Testament knows of a shadow of this unforgivable sin. See Hebrews 10 verse 28 and 29. If anyone has violated the law of Moses, he will die without mercy at the testimony of two or three witnesses. How much worse punishment do you think will be deserved by the man who has trampled down the Son of God? The writer sees a similarity between the greatest sin of the Old Testament and the unpardonable sin of the New Testament. There will come an end to God's mercy. Although he sees a similarity, he also sees a difference. The aforementioned sin remained pardonable in the Old Testament, but no longer in the days of the New Testament. We should especially consider the third part of this comparison. In the Old Testament dispensation, there remained hope, even through extreme punishment, while the New Testament dispensation does not allow for this any longer, for the grace has grown more abundant in the meantime. This is why the church in the Old Testament dispensation could not come to her total elimination. In the most terrible judgment that came upon the Old Testament church because of her adultery, the possibility of mercy still existed. A promise of salvation could yet follow the prophecy of judgment. But this does not mean that mercy has to again follow the judgment upon the harlotry of the church in the final days of the New Testament. Nor is it necessary that John should end with a message of grace, as Ezekiel did when he spoke of the same sins and judgments. Reverend Ploy then continues with, "But we will ask ourselves, is besides the church city also the world city called harlot in the prophecies of the Old Testament?" He answers this question positively when referring to Isaiah 23 verse 17, Jeremiah 51 verse 7, and Nahum 3 verse 4. Which speak of the adultery of Tyre, Babylon, and Nineveh, respectively. This is true, but who is denying it? I would not consider it for a moment. However, nothing has been proven as far as Revelation 17 is concerned. The Old Testament, on occasion, speaks of the adultery of a world center. But how often was this done in comparison to the many times in which the Lord reprimands his church people for adultery? I would not like to number the occurrences which indicate the adultery of the church. When Reverend Ploy, in his discussion, refers to some passages, three in total, where the adultery of the world is last against, then I am able to point out against this a continuous testimony from the Old Testament which turn itself against the adultery of the church. If they were counted, then it could be very well possible that there would be 300 passages. In the question of the Old Testament basis of Revelation 17, I would have many more passages at my disposal than does Reverend Ploy. D. Now I come to verse 18a, where the harlot is called the great city, the Paulus. I have already made a few remarks on this with my rejection of the cultural opinion. I have yet this to add. This data by itself is not decisive for the ecclesiastical interpretation. Rome and the world state can also be called Paulus in the Greek New Testament. But this word does not plead against the thought of false church. The ecclesiastical meaning of the term is established by many in several places. Compare Smith's book. One particular place in connection with this, of great importance for the justification of my opinion, is Revelation 11 verse 8. Reverend Ploy assumes correctly that I believe, as well as he himself, that a great city always holds the same meaning throughout the book of Revelation. Therefore, also in 11 verse 8, I consider the text to be referring to the church city. Reverend Ploy does not agree with me. He writes, "Yet may I remind you in all soberness that our Lord was not crucified in, but outside of Jerusalem, and also not by Jerusalem, but by Rome." Thus many witnesses of the Lord may often be handed over by Jerusalem, the false Jews, but they are actually killed on the grounds of Babylon. Here he refers to what happened in the 16th and 19th centuries. The false Jews accused and provoked, but the state, city, executed. I will match Reverend Ploy in his solemnity. With his first comment, he, I believe, has Hebrews 13 verse 12 in mind, where it says that Jesus suffered outside the gate in the form of the sacrificial law for the Day of Atonement. I also believe that this is a tremendously rich message, one which I have preached about with elation. But Reverend Ploy is not allowed to solve it in the following manner. He is killed outside the gate. He is outside Jerusalem. He is on the territory of Babylon. Does Reverend Ploy perhaps believe that in those days the jurisdiction of Rome ended at the walls of Jerusalem, so that inside Jerusalem would mean on the territory of the church, and outside Jerusalem on the territory of the world city? Pilate had his residence inside the wall of Jerusalem, and there he gave Jesus up to death on the cross. In other words, the author of the Bible never gave it a moment of thought that outside the gate must be understood as on the territory of the world empire. Hebrews 13 verse 12 does not contain a single argument against the thesis, the harlot is the false church. Concerning his second comment, I am well aware that the Jews needed authorization from Rome in order to execute this judgment, but I would never endorse his statement that Jesus is not crucified by Jerusalem but by Rome. For Christ, in the interrogation before Pilate, condemns Jerusalem more than Rome. Compare John 19, verse 11. I will now use this opportunity to write down, in all soberness, some texts as well. Acts 2, verse 23. Him, Jesus, being delivered up by the predetermined plan and foreknowledge of God, you, Jews, nailed to a cross by the hands of unrighteous men, and put to death. The church city executed the sentence of the cross, albeit through the hands of the Romans. Acts 3 verse 15. But you put to death the Prince of Life. Peter said this to the people of Jerusalem. Acts 4 verse 10. By the name of Jesus Christ the Nazarene, whom you crucified. Thus Peter spoke to the Sanhedrin. Acts 5 verse 30. Jesus, whom you murdered by hanging him on a tree. Peter again to the Sanhedrin. Acts 7 verse 52. Which one of the prophets did your fathers not persecute? And they killed those who previously announced the coming of the righteous one, whose betrayers and murderers you have now become. It is strange that Reverend Ploy thinks that I lack common sense when I consider John 11 verse 8 to point to Jerusalem. This last text is very important because here it is said that murder of prophets is not a single incident in the church city, but her practice. Just like Christ himself did say, O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, who kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to her. Matthew 23 verse 37. All these verses strengthen me in my opinion that the great city in Revelation 11 is Jerusalem, the church city. This does not mean yet that the great city simply always points to Jerusalem. But I feel very strongly about this, especially on the grounds of Revelation 16 verse 19, where the great city is distinguished from the pagan cities. According to me, this favors again the opinion that by the great city in Revelation, one should constantly think of the false church, also in Revelation 17 verse 18. Now we have arrived at the next point. E. It is said of the woman that she is the great city, which has the kingship over the kings of the earth. It looks like this is a major political addition. Yet questions do come up in my mind. For I can imagine that in this way there is spoken of one particular world city in ancient times. Nineveh, Babylon, Asshur, and in John's days, Rome. Thus there would be one particular place, distinguished from other places. In the opinion which I disputed, the great city is not seen as one city, which officiates as world center, but as world state, world dominion, and world empire. Then it is understood that in this sense the great city has already been presented in the preceding chapter as a well-known greatness. But then I do not understand anything of the opposition which captures our attention here, for then we will get this paraphrase. The woman is the world empire which has dominion over the kings of the earth. What is the use then of this opposition? There is nothing in it which was not included in the great city already. It seems to me that this addition is totally senseless in that case. But something else is still more important to me. This world empire is still presented here as the beast with seven heads. And John says emphatically in 13 verse 3 that it received a deadly wound in one of its heads. In other words, the empire is collapsing at a given moment, and to everyone's astonishment does not lift itself up again until later. I think this refers to the downfall of the Roman Empire. For more details, see my speech on the Church and the Last Judgment. At that time, for instance, one head did not make room for another, as had happened with the end of other world powers, so the empire could continue to exist in another form. Yet, at that time, the beast itself fell torpidly to the earth. For the time being, it was not possible to speak of a world power anymore. And I am also of the opinion that John is also hinting at this in our chapter, when he in verse 8 and 11 speaks of the beast, which was and is not. Although the beast consequently lays fatally wounded on the earth, not to scramble to its feet until later, the woman is still going strong in playing her role. Her destruction does not come until at the beginning of the Eighth Empire. There is between the sixth and the seventh head of the beast a time without empire. But the woman exercises her dominion during this time, as well as during the Seventh Empire. This makes it impossible for me to recognize the woman as a world power, for she is in full power also when the empire apparently had been ruined forever. Therefore, I still believe this to be strong grounds, besides the many other motives which I mentioned earlier, by which to distinguish beast and harlot, and to see this last figure as the false church, which herself exercises imperialistic power with her influence into all independent kingdoms, also in the ages when there is no empire. F. When the people of the Lord are told to go out from her, 18 verse 4 and further, we can understand this from a world city, but not from a world empire. For it is not possible to withdraw from it. A person could leave the city of Rome, as well as the city of Nineveh, or Babylon, but no one can withdraw himself from the grasp of the world empire. Joseph and Mary could not escape from the power of Augustus, and as such could not go out of the world empire. But this summons indeed becomes meaningful when we think of the great city of the false church as a concrete community within the world. It is possible to break the connection with her. This is why it appears to me that this verse is again decisively pointing into the direction of the ecclesiastical interpretation. G. This was already dealt with in the rejection of the cultural opinion, and actually it was also indicated already that there is no way of thinking of the harlot as world power, simply because this power still existed after the woman had already perished forever. The political structure is still complete at that time. Then one has to come to the conclusion it was the false church which was swept away forever. 8. This woman is said to be drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the witnesses of Jesus, 17 verse 6, 18 verse 20 and 24, 19 verse 2. Now it is remarkable that in 17 verse 6 a distinction is made between saints and witnesses of Jesus. I am aware that also New Testament believers often are called saints. The question yet enters my mind, whether or not we are to think of the pious ones of the Old Testament here. This would not be strange in the chapter, which has such strong lines of resemblance to Daniel 7, pertaining to the signs of the world empires. In this same chapter of Daniel, the pious ones of the Old Testament are several times referred to in the Dort Study Bible as the saints of the high places. Verse 18. Alders, in his Korte Verklaring, writes correctly, the saints of the Most High. There's a footnote. Thus also in the King James Version. This way of speaking still exists in the New Testament. Compare Matthew 27 verse 52, where it speaks of many bodies of the saints which had passed away and at the time of the death of Christ were raised. Then in our verse we would also have a classification of the believers. On the one hand, the saints of the Old Testament, and on the other hand, the witnesses of Jesus as an indication of the martyrs of the New Testament. And thus we could come to the conclusion that the harlot, also in the days of the Old Testament, appeared as false judges and laid violent hands upon the lives of God's faithful children. Actually, even if the suggestion in connection to the term saints is not correct, I certainly will not give it that much authority, then the thesis that a harlot is the false church which already operated in the days of the Old Testament still constantly receives a great deal of support from the texts mentioned. For, in 18 verse 20, it signifies that God, with the destruction of the harlot, settled the account she had with the holy apostles and the prophets. It is their judgment which the Lord executes over her. For, as it says in verse 24, in her is found the blood of the prophets and of the saints and of everyone who was slain on the earth. The prophets, these are undoubtedly God's ambassadors of the Old Testament. The saints, see above, perhaps the Old Testament believers. All who are slain on the earth would then be a summary of the New Testament martyrs. In any case, it is certain that a woman, already in the days of the Old Testament, played her role as murderess of God's servants and children. Now I will come back for a minute to my remarks on 2b. I was speaking there in connection with the sitting of the woman upon the seven kings from her historical position. It has been said already that a woman is sitting on the beast as harlot and murderess, and that she is supported by the beast, and that she also performs her function until the days of the eighth king. I on purpose left the question when the manifestation of the woman began. It appears now that she was already doing her gruesome work in the days of the world empires, the five which had vanished already in the days of John. In other words, the harlot is a concrete power which manifests itself through all ages in alliance with the beast and is nevertheless distinguished from it. The prophets were angry, were they not, against the apostate Israel, which broke the covenant with the Lord and entered into a covenant relationship with the world powers of those days. For which power laid violent hands upon the blood of the prophets? The world empire? Or the apostate church. I already showed that Reverend Ploy is incorrect in his opinion that it is always the city, the state, which carried out the executions. Rome did not crucify Christ. Jerusalem did. It was not the empire, but the false church. But there is something more to add. In his argument, Reverend Ploy did not take into consideration that the harlot, also in the days of the Old Testament, killed the prophets. This again puts us on the track to identify the harlot who murdered the prophets. Again, a number of verses. 1 Kings 19 verse 10. The children of Israel, not the Assyrians, have slain thy prophets. By whom did Jeremiah suffer? And Amos? When Jesus chastised the Pharisees, he also said, Matthew 23 verse 35, that upon you may come all the righteous blood which is shed on the earth, from the blood of the righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah, whom you murdered between the temple and the altar. All murders which were committed against the prophets in the days of the Old Testament are put to the account of the apostate Israel, even without any cooperation of a world empire at all. I am therefore of the opinion that the question which power we have to understand behind the woman who slew the prophets can only be answered with, it was Jerusalem, the false church. I refer here also to the verses mentioned before, Matthew 23 verse 37 and Acts 7 verse 52. In the days of the Old Testament, it was always the ecclesiastical body who persecuted those who lived in holiness according to the word of the Lord. Let us now also then render the account. In the days of the Old Testament, it was the harlot who drank herself drunk with the blood of the prophets and saints, the apostate Israel, Jerusalem. In John's own time, Revelation 2 verse 9, the Jews were the ones who persecuted God's church, because of which they were called a synagogue of Satan. The false church at the end of time was also identified as harlot by Gridanus. The harlot is again and again the same power in the beginning, middle, and end of history. Perhaps Reverend Ploy will by now understand why I cannot follow Gridanus when he identifies the harlot to be, time and again, a different power. First the great Babylon, then especially the Roman world power of those days, and again at another time some different incorporation or world power, and finally the Papal Rome. In Court of Verklaring 252. Over against that, I say that although the false church manifests itself every time in a different form, in the days of Ahab different than in the days of John, and in the time of the Antichrist different again, the woman is still a constant greatness, just as the beast is a constant greatness. She is always distinguished from the beast, although she is sitting on it. Indeed, if the harlot is on the one hand this and on the other that, how would it be possible to obey the admonition, "Go out from her"? The latter is only possible when she, at all times, represents the same greatness. That the harlot as constant greatness is to be distinguished from the beast, not only once in a while, but permanently, now also receives support from, the announcement mentioned in Revelation 18 verse 9, that the kings which committed adultery with her are in mourning, when they see her total destruction. In the beginning, I already pointed out that we have to see the suggested adultery as an action between two parties, so that we have to make a distinction between the harlot and the kings of the earth. These latter ones are bearers of political power and, as such, are representatives of the world empire, and during the time of the collapse of this empire are the rulers of smaller territories. In all cases, they are political entities. That they are distinguished from the harlot appears also from this, that they are still functioning after the harlot has perished definitely. Otherwise, it would be impossible for them to act as mourners, as is mentioned in 18 verse 9. K. Also significant is what it says in 19 verse 7 and following. As soon as the harlot has perished, the marriage feast of the Lamb is coming, and then his wife is preparing herself. There is certainly dramatic power in this vision. The harlot has to perish, and then comes the exalted day of the bride. For harlot and bride are two female characters. The first one forgot the marriage's fidelity, while the second prepared herself for this. It seems to me that this contrast certainly has something to say also. I admit, I would never base the whole exegesis on this contrast. Only on the basis of the bride in 19 verse 7 as portraying the true church, I could not call the harlot the false church. But it becomes apparent in a totally different way that we, with harlot, must think of the false church. Thus, this exegesis receives confirmation from this verse in retrospect, and our insight in the message of this chapter is intensified. For, and with this I switch over to the data classified under 1, we should pay attention to the question, what motivated John to portray the character mentioned here as a woman, or rather, what did God intend when he portrayed this power to us as a woman? If the world empire is meant here, then this question is difficult to answer. It is possible to say that this character of a woman is necessary in order to denounce her idolatrous practices, which are already called adultery in the Old Testament. I would expect this answer if not at the same time this world empire was shown to us in the recurring form of the beast. If it would be only a simple matter of idolatrous practices of the world power, then I could imagine that here, as well as in Isaiah 23 verse 17, Jeremiah 51 verse 7, and Nahum 3 verse 4, a character of a woman is brought into the picture. But there is a lot more at stake in this chapter on account of her power, her murder, her drunkenness, her culture, and her cooperation with political powers. The above answer becomes unacceptable when John embodies the political power in the beast and emphatically distinguishes the woman from the beast. Also, the annotations to the Dort Study Bible put their explanation of the character of this woman immediately in antithesis with the one of chapter 12. Point A of the data under 1 is settled with this. The points B up to and including F, as well as 8, came up for discussion in the previous articles already, with the discussion of the corresponding data of the second series. Thus, there remains only one point which I mentioned under 1, namely G, the name of this woman. I wrote that John says that this name is a mystery. Thus, we should not think of the city Babylon, nor of the state Babylon, but this name must be understood in a spiritually transmitted way. Reverend Ploy has some objections. He says, here we have to observe immediately that it certainly is a very inaccurate representation of the text to say that John calls the name of Babylon on the forehead of the woman a mystery. It says in Revelation 17 verse 5, and on her forehead a name written mystery, does it not? John does not call her name a mystery, but he says that her name is mystery. This inaccuracy immediately offenses itself, according to me, when mystery is deprived of her very definite name character, and with Professor Holweda gets an adverbial character, in the sense of spiritually transmitted. Nothing is left here of the specific meaning of mystery, a revelation historical defined term. End of quote from Reverend Ploy. It seems like a telling blow at first glance. A very inaccurate representation of the text, for her name is mystery. Moreover, just like the attaching an adverbial quality to a name, apparently a proper name. And further on, not leaving anything of the specific meaning of a revelation historical defined term. Still, it seems more important and substantial than it is. For, A, I believe that Reverend Ploy wrote these severe sentences with too much haste and without having consulted his Greek New Testament. Nestle, at least in the 1932 edition, which I used, did not include mystery at all in the name. He does not place the capitals until he presents the Greek text of the Great Babylon, and as such does not start the name until then. Therefore, I may translate the Greek text just as well in this way, and on her forehead was written a name, a mystery, the Great Babylon, etc. Does Reverend Ploy want more examples? He should consult Sclater, Charles, Bousset, Baim, Moffat, Commentary and New Translation, Lohmeyer, Kubel, Goodspeed, Jansen, Canisius Translation, Bornkamp by Kettle 4, just to name a few, which are immediately available to me. I also know that some include mystery in the name itself, but most of the ones I read certainly do not. B. Gridanus does include mystery in the name, but he still indicates this is not a proper name, but a symbolic description of her being. Korte Verklaring, page 254. In other words, Gridanus, in spite of his translation, chooses essentially against Reverend Ploy, no proper name, and thus is not that far removed from my opinion. Symbolic description. And the others, which I mentioned before in succession, translate as I did, a symbolic name. C. I really do not understand what the weighty, revelation historical defined term here means, written even with an exclamation mark. I am very interested in the history of revelation, and I probably know what Reverend Ploy means when he says that the term mystery is defined revelation historically. But I believe that he should not apply this word so haphazardly. For not everywhere in the New Testament does this term receive the same definition and character. May I refer him to Kittel? I believe that I did not commit an inaccuracy as such, and can peacefully maintain that John describes that we have to understand the Great Babylon symbolically and metaphorically. I have already explained at length why I understand this name as symbolic of the false church. D. The text of Revelation 17 itself also could have taught him that mystery does not belong to the proper name. The angel prepares himself in verse 7 to tell him the mystery of the woman. Here the thought is obvious that there is something dark and mysterious about the name Babylon, which the woman bears, for it needs explanation. This would not have been necessary if the woman had been the embodiment of the world empire. John and his readers know the scriptures well enough to know that the empire of their day was the continuation of the former Babylon. There was no mystery in this for them. But what did need an explanation was this, that beside the empire there was a different concrete body, which did not bear the official name Babylon. Nor was it an empire, but essentially it still deserved the name Babylon because of her style and atmosphere. Mystery, in my opinion, also points in the ecclesiastical direction. Reverend Ploy seems to take it ill of me that I did not refer to the many scripture passages which are quoted in his Bible, published by Brandt. I myself do not have this edition. I always enjoy it when a Bible edition contains a lot of references. I do not know who took care of these references in the Brandt edition, but this reference work as such is not necessarily authoritative. Reverend Ploy may be made aware that I indeed examined these references, but a lot more than just those of this short list. I get the impression that he comes to the conclusion that because in these references there is spoken of the world empire Babylon, and because John sometimes even literally quotes these places, that he, John, also must have a view on this world empire. Yet I think this to be too simplistic. The issue of the manner in which Revelation gives quotations from the Old Testament and takes up characters out of this book and processes them in its own visions and symbols is in general much more complicated. One should not simply conclude that Isaiah 21 verse 9 is referring to the world empire of Babylon, and that consequently Revelation 18 verse 2, which took over this word of Isaiah, does the same. Naturally, I cannot widely discuss this problem of the use of the Old Testament in the last book of the Bible within the confines of this presentation. But as far as method and style is concerned, in which John goes to work here, I had a lot of help from Schatter in his German book about the Old Testament in the Revelation of John, 1912. Furthermore, I will mention for this aspect of the argument A. Ferrer, A Rebirth of Images, 1949. I believe it to be essential to first orientate oneself to some extent with the general method which John follows before making far-reaching conclusions from certain quotations of the Old Testament. Moreover, I fail to understand why Reverend Ploy, when reading parallels from the Old Testament, limits himself to texts which speak of the world empire. Why did he not give Revelation 18 verse 22 and 23 a reference to Jeremiah 25 verse 10, which emphatically deals with Jerusalem? It is fine with me if someone wants to draw parallels, but not biased ones. And in conclusion, I am of the opinion that exactly the fact that John, when he introduces this woman to us as the Great Babylon, and precedes this with the signal of attention, remember, this is a mystery, that exactly this fact has to guide us also in the consideration of the texts mentioned by Reverend Ploy. John saw the spirit of Babylon disclosed in the apostate church. Therefore, all the threats which the prophets had spoken against Babylon also applied, without any reservations, to this unfaithful people of the Lord. Thus, in the destruction of the harlot, he could see fulfilled all the prophecies against Babylon. That is why he could also in his description of the judgment on the harlot digest everything which before was spoken of by the prophets against Babylon. It is easy to apply to the world power of the present all the sins which the Old Testament lashes onto the world powers of that time, and all the judgments which it announces upon it. But it is a lot more difficult to determine this sinful spirit in a greatness which presents itself totally different and, as such, conceals her real being. Especially because of this, very careful exegesis is a necessity so that we withdraw ourselves from the grasp of this woman, have no participation in her sins, and thus flee the judgment which awaits her. For I did not write or speak to snub others. The danger stood before me that also this time, just as again and again in history, the Reformation would be followed with a renewed adultery. I do not have a smooth theory of true or false church, and none of us need it. But it is a question of life and death for us all, that we stay faithful to the Lord and keep His covenant. For this reason I spoke and wrote this brochure in addition to it, so that we might understand the scriptures, believe them, and keep them.